So today's class, let's go to the book of Daniel to start with this morning. Today's class, probably of all of them, will kind of be the most sort of historical. And but in order to have a... let's go to Daniel first. Go to Daniel 2 and put something there, like a bookmark or something. And then let's go to Acts chapter 6. And I want to explain why this history is important, especially for the New Testament. So I want you to have the background. In Acts chapter 6, which we have the story of this, we call it the Jewish church in Jerusalem, because it's a Jewish context. At this point, no one is really thinking in terms of this, you know, worldwide Christian church. They are Jewish believers in Christ. That's a whole other study, of course, but... this is strongly the context in Jerusalem. The apostles are Jewish. You have Gentile proselytes and so on. They're meeting. They're going in the temple. They're worshiping in the temple. They do not see themselves as a group that has been displaced from Judaism. That is yet to come. And it's in this context, you'll notice in chapter 6, verse 1, in those days when the number of disciples was increasing, I think we can imply believers in Jesus Christ, right? They bled in the blood atonement of Jesus Christ for salvation. The Grecian, or some of your translations may have Hellenistic, Jews, among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows, that is the Grecian widows, were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. So the 12 gathered all the disciples together and said, "It would not be right for us to neglect the ministry of the word of God in order to wait on tables. Brothers, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the Spirit and wisdom. We will turn this responsibility over to them and will give our attention to prayer and the ministry of the word." So, of course, the context here is basically, hey, no fair. You know, you've got these Jews, they're Jews, okay? And I wouldn't be surprised when they got together that we may have, you know, been like this, you know. And maybe the Grecian or Hellenistic Jews over here and the Hebraic Jews over here, and there's this conflict, and they're saying, wait a minute, why are their widows getting more food and more support than our widows? This isn't fair. And obviously it was happening. No one said, no, that's not right. They looked at it and said, okay, we better take care of this. And so they said, listen, Peter and James and John said, our ministry is a certain ministry of teaching and proclamation, and we need some people here to settle this. You guys take care of this. So you three over here, up here in the front row, you take care of this. You guys get together, figure this out, and make sure it's taken care of. We want people who are all full of the Holy Spirit. And remember, these people were not just table waiters. Some people make a point of that word, that the servant, there's the idea of table waiter. But don't forget, Stephen, who gives that impassionate speech in Acts chapter 7, right? He was one of these guys. So these were very powerful people in the spirit. But the point is, how did we get to this place in the first century where you've got these two obviously distinct groups of Jews? Their language, their culture, their food, their lifestyle. And how would it be that Jews could get together and have this ethnic divide between the two? So how we get to that point is really the story of this 400 years between the Testaments, and this story also greatly impacts the culture and the context of Christianity in the first century. When I say the first century, right, I'm talking about 0 to 100, okay? Which, of course, is the time of Christ, the time of the apostles, the wrap-up of the apostolic era, in a sense of John, you know, if John lived to be the longest, and then we think he was 90 years old or something, if he's contemporary with Christ, is toward the end of the first century. So how did we get to this context in the first century that is so different from the close of the Old Testament? Why is it when you read the New Testament quotations, for example, by Paul and Peter, but especially in Paul, when you read his Old Testament quotations, and you compare it to your Old Testament, which is based on the Hebrew Masoretic text, why are they sometimes so different? Well, Paul is quoting from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was basically the working Bible that he used, when he read the Bible, he read from the Greek translation, and there were differences from the Hebrew translation. How did we get to this point? That's why we're doing this. So this particular class today is going to be a little bit more of a history lesson. I understand that, because we don't have a lot of biblical narrative, except where we start here in Acts. And if you go back to Daniel now, and we'll just quickly peruse, obviously studying Daniel, the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, which was written in Aramaic, which is already a later development of the Hebrew language, but from the Persian, but it's a sister tongue. Aramaic is the tongue that Jesus spoke, and you know, you could understand it if you knew Hebrew, but it's there's some differences. And the book of Daniel, I would compare it, and I would say it's in the Old Testament, it is what Revelation is to the New Testament, right? Revelation is a book that a lot of people really look at and say, wow, that's a lot. I just, you know, you kind of give up on it and so on. And if you read through it to the end, but you will notice that the book of Revelation in your Bible, you will notice it's called Revelation, not what? Yes, people always talk about revelations, which is plural. And that's why is Revelation singular? It's because the purpose of the book is the unveiling of Jesus Christ. That's why it's one revelation. It's the unveiling of the coming Christ and his glory. That's the revelation. That's what it is. And so the book of Daniel, likewise, is, if you think of, when you read Daniel, if you think of how you should read Revelation, when you read Revelation, our tendency from the West, I don't mean from the Northwest or, you know, west of Mississippi, I'm talking about Western culture, which our roots are in Europe, our tendency is to read things linear. You know, that's how I think, you know, point one, point two, point three, point four. Remember that the Bible comes from an Oriental culture, you know, the probably the premier biblical archaeological museums and so on in the United States is the Oriental Institute in the University of Chicago. And that's where Mesopotamia, Assyrian, biblical archaeology, is because it's part of the Oriental world, and thinking is not so much linear. That's why when you come to the book of Revelation, you don't always want to read it and try to figure it out, you know, this chapter, this chapter, this chapter. You have to remember that John looks out and talks about this, and he comes back, and he goes here and talks about this again, and that's why you have the seals, the vials, the different things like that. And in Daniel, you have a similar situation where you have different visions and unveilings, the focus of which are these world empires that are to come. So think of Daniel written toward the end of the old, very end of the Old Testament era. We know the context where they're in captivity, and he goes through some different, you know, kings and so forth. But so if you go to chapter 2, and obviously this is a whole deep study. This is like trying to survey Revelation. But real quickly, if you go to chapter 2 and verse 39, we're in the middle of this vision of this statue. I've got a big picture of this. Our students in Bible instruction have, you know, this big statue. And there's these four parts to this body, and it represents the coming world empires. And the first is Babylon, and then Persia, and then, verse 39, after you, because he's speaking to the Persian Empire, after you, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours. I'm sorry, he's talking to the king of Babylon, and real quickly, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours, Persia. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom. So what we're talking about in this study is this third and fourth kingdom. Last week, we talked about the second kingdom, Persia, and Babylon, Persia, to kind of set the stage. Now we're into the area of these third and fourth kingdoms that give us this interlude between the Old and New Testament. So jump to chapter 7 and verse 6. In chapter 7 and verse 6, again, we have this dream. This time we have a dream, and you can go back and read this yourself. And, you can see in verse 2, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the other, came out. So we got four again. We get to this third one. After that, in verse 6, I looked, and there was before me another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, remember that, and was given authority to rule. After that, my vision eye, I looked, and there before me was the fourth beast. Okay, the fourth beast is going to be the Roman Empire. Chapter 8, verse 21. So you can see how we're kind of like Revelation. You're kind of getting the same story over again. It's not so much just linear. But notice this, in verse 8, chapter 8, verse 21. Again, we've got another vision. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece. And the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same staying power. So what he's predicting here happens so accurately, as we're going to see in just a few moments, that this is why there's been a lot of, you know, criticism. Well, this couldn't possibly have been written beforehand. Because this is one of the most distinct prophecies in the Bible that you look at history and say, well, you can't debate this happened. The debate is more, well, how could he have known that? This obviously was written after the fact. Follow? I'm not saying we agree with that, but I'm just saying that's the criticism level against Daniel because it is so accurate. Chapter 11 and verses 1 to 4. And your prince, in the first day, in the first day of the year of King Darius, the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. Now then, I tell you the truth, three more kings will appear in Persia, then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gathered power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece, and a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he please. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. Verse 5, the king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger, and he will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. Go on and read this yourself if you want to get in the detail. And so what we're dealing with here is the history of the time from the Persian Empire to the Roman Empire. And Daniel is so clear on what's going to happen. Like I say, most biblical critics will say, well, obviously this was written after the fact because it's way too accurate. Okay, no one disputes the fact that what he says here is what happened. Now, I'm going to try this without... Okay. Got it. Oh, not quite. Okay. Earlier my problem was, where is the button that blanks this? And we found it. It says B-L-A-N-K. Okay, so I can turn this off, I think, up front here. So, is that okay? Are you guys okay? We're not going to be reading the Bible so much now anyway. So this is the world of the biblical world plus way over east toward India, okay? And so let me just give you a quick survey of what happened. Over far on the left, you know what, I need to kind of stay close to this, so this is going to be a little complicated. On the left over here in the map, and we're looking at a map of the Mediterranean world all the way from Greece to Persia, so if you're listening on the audio, you can get a map out in your Bible. So on the far left is the area of what we call Macedonia, which is north of Greece. You got to remember in the Greek world, what you have are city-states. So a city-state, basically, it'd be like if Seattle was its own empire, Portland was its own empire, much, of course, inferior, San Francisco, and so forth, and where the Trojans, Southern Cal, Trojans, well, okay, where'd that name come from? This Michigan State, Spartans, Southern California, Trojans, okay, Sparta, Troy, Athens, these were city-states. They were not empires. They each had their own king. And while the Persians tried to invade Greece, and we talked about that last week, and were defeated by a consortium, and this is what happened in the Old Testament as well. When Israel invaded the Promised Land, Jericho was a city-state. Ai was a city-state. Bethel was a city-state. Jerusalem was a city-state. They would form together in confederations when they needed to fight off enemies and then break up again. So Greece was full of city-states. That's why you have the Peloponnesian Wars, the various history of the wars where they fought each other, okay? And to make a quick long story short, up north in Macedonia, which is really, even today we talk about Macedonia, up north in that area, you see up there where it says Pella, in that area up north where it's green, a ruler, a king, Philip of Macedonia, came to power, and he eventually conquered or united and basically conquered the area, the main city-states of Greece, and pretty much put them under his authority. He became basically the first monarch, if you will, of that area of the world that was not just a city-state. He took over this area just as the Babylonians did in their world and in the Persians. And it was his son who, and it wasn't necessarily a nice transfer of power. It was typical monarchical type dealings where you've got multiple wives, you've got children of these wives who are, you know, which one's really the legitimate future king. So there were these family divisions, serious divisions going on. One of his sons, Alexander, obviously, felt he had a right to the throne. Philip's current wife thought her children, you know, that's how that goes. Well, Philip died rather suddenly in about 36 BC, so before Christ, right? Sometimes you will see the dates these days that says BCE, and that simply means what? Before the common era, okay? I mean, if you're not a Christian, if you're Jewish or Muslim or whatever, and you're dating the world by trying to date with Western calendars, you don't necessarily want to say before Christ, so you say before the common era. It's the same thing, okay? So 336-ish BC, before Christ, before the common era, when Alexander in that area, at that time, Philip, his father, dies, Alexander gathers the power quickly. And the typical, you know, things that go on with all the intrigue that you make a good TV miniseries, you know. He becomes the new emperor. His father had already launched an invasion into Persia. And that had been going on. When Alexander took over, he quickly made sure everybody in Macedonia, in Greece and Macedonia, was under his authority. And then he began the march east. And there's plenty of resources you can get to read about this and so forth. He begins the march east, and so you can see on the map, if you follow the red arrows, you can see where his march goes. He crosses over into Asia, when, you know, that's why in the Bible, where it says Sardis up here, modern-day Turkey is in the Bible is called what? Asia Minor. It's part of the Asian continent. Here's India. China's that way. This is part of the Asian continent. Far East, the Mid East, the Near East, right? This is the Mid East, okay? This is Asia Minor. He goes over there, and you have to read, if you want to read the histories, there's plenty of synopsises of this. He begins conquering, and he's successful. There are some setbacks, there's no doubt. It's interesting, the cities he goes through are the ones we read about in the Bible. Sardis, where Apostle Paul went. Ephesus. Very significant place where Alexander went. Huge part of the New Testament. Then he goes back up into this way, up central, kind of north central. And then you'll notice he comes down, and one of the places that's marked on the map is Tarsus, where somebody famous in the New Testament hails from. As who? Saul of Tarsus. And when he goes to Tarsus, he actually gets his health is, could have been very serious. He could have died there. He recovers. He spent time there. And from Tarsus, then he begins going through. You'll notice he goes down through Palestine, Lebanon, Tyre and Sidon, modern day in Lebanon. And there's some significant battles along the way. He goes all the way down into Egypt and an area where eventually a city called Alexandria, we'll talk about that, is a very important city. It's not touched on a lot in the New Testament, but like I mentioned last week, probably the largest, maybe the largest Jewish population in the world ends up by New Testament times in Alexandria, Egypt. So when he goes down through here, and then he ends up in Egypt, and he conquers and allies himself and conquers the Egyptian empire, if you will, that part of the Persian. Then he goes back up north through Jerusalem area, and we'll talk about that in a minute, all the way back up north of Nineveh, these Old Testament areas, Babylon, Susa, Persian Empire, all the way, and you'll see it follows up north into India and conquers this whole area. I mean, this is a huge empire, comes back through the south, back up in this area, and eventually dies near Babylon. He never gets back to Macedonia. He died in apparently, again, this literature, he apparently died in sort of a drunken state. He was quite a drinker. And of course, he had his enemies and so forth. He survived more than one near-death experience in battle. He led his armies into battle. He was at the front, and that's why his life was always in danger. And but I mean, look at the empire he conquered. I mean, from Macedonia to India to Egypt. So he conquered this whole empire. This is now part of, it's not really the Greek Empire, it's really Macedonian. The word Hellenist in the New Testament is the word for Greek, and this is why it's called Hellenist, because we're going to see next week a little more detail how Hellenist culture changed the world. Yes, Linda.
How long did that take him, roughly?
He died, this is about 12, I think he had about 12 years total from this whole time. He was in his, I think, 30s when he died. He wasn't very old when he started. Yeah. And so, he was a young man, basically, by today's standards. He'd be Dulles age, okay, when he died. So let's finish the story. So what happens, this is the empire that Daniel has predicted. In fact, he even used the word Greece. I mean, he predicted this world empire, and this was a world empire. This was the biggest world empire the world has ever seen. When he died, he had no son who was a normal successor to his kingdom. He had wives, more than one, and children. But when he died, what happened is his empire, what did Daniel say? After this empire comes an end, there will be what?
Four
empires. Daniel specifically says it will be broken into four parts. Okay, those four parts were not his children, they were his generals. The Greek Empire, the Macedonian Empire, basically divided into four areas with four generals at the head of each area. The two that impact the Bible significantly then, to set the stage for the New Testament, down here in the dark, in the brown here, Ptolemy. His general was probably, I would say, maybe his strongest general, with his headquarters near, you see Alexandria, Memphis is down here, is Alexandria. Ptolemy controlled Egypt. The Seleucid Empire, the Seleucid, was up here just north, Turkey, Asia Minor, Lebanon area, Antioch, Babylon. These are the two areas that were particular in Asia Minor. These are the areas that are so important when it comes to the New Testament. These two generals. More in the periphery, that the Greek islands and so forth, not as significant. One is pretty small up there, Macedonia, and then the Greek islands. But these empires, these two especially, Ptolemy and Seleucus Empire, what is the buffer between their empires?
Israel.
Palestine, Canaan. That's the buffer. And because of that, there are significant battles back and forth. So Ptolemy the first, one of the things he did is he went up north and conquered and brought back, according to Josephus, I think it's 120,000 Jews back to Egypt. Okay? So what's happened, what's his interest in history? Let me just read, this is in Josephus. Now, Josephus is the Jewish historian who later on travels with the Roman army under Titus. He's Jewish, he's working for the Romans, okay? His history, what did you tell me last week on the way home? All historians, what? Think theirs is correct.
Well, he says I'm the only one.
Right, yeah.
Do the proper history.
Yeah, yeah. Gene said, he quoting him, and says, I'm the only one who can write this history properly.
Yeah.
Well, I think most historians feel that way, right? Okay? Whatever. Anyway, and so he chronicles the story of Alexander coming back through Jerusalem, going down through the Palestine, no one else really chronicles this. It's Jewish legend. It's Jewish history. But, you know, we have American history, like I mentioned, the way, you know, we know about Davy Crockett, for example. Well, there's a lot of legend that's not true, we know. But there was a Davy Crockett, right? And he did live. And he did die at the Alamo, okay? So this legend has history. Some of the history of this talks about how he comes down and he meets, it's quite a section here. Let me just tell you this. If you have a copy of Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, there's a section here you can find in chapter 8, I believe, in mine anyway, where he comes down to Jerusalem. Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priest, the Jewish priest, stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple, the high Jewish priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having a golden plate on which the name of God was engraved, he approached by himself and adored that name and first saluted the high priest. Well, it sounds a little embellished, okay? The Jews also did come together with one voice, salute Alexander and encompass him about, whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind. However, Parmenio alone went up to him, asked how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom he replied, I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with the high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream in this very habit when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion of the Persians. Whereas is having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering the vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army in a divine conduct, shall therewith conquer Darius, destroy the power of the Persians, and all things that succeed according what is in my mind. And when he had said this to Parmenio, had given the high priest his right hand, the priest ran along by him and came to the city. He went up the temple, he offered sacrifice to God according to the high priest's direction, magnificently treated both the high priest and the priest. And when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persian, he supposed that himself was that person intended. Well, that's Josephus, okay? But it's Jewish legend and history. Legends generally come from somewhere. We do know this. He treated Jerusalem, compared to what he did to other cities, very favorably. Okay? So that's kind of the story of Josephus about this time period. After this comes to an end, he dies as a young man. His four generals take over his empire. The next... We're talking, you know, early 300 toward the changeover from 300 to the 200s now, BC, where we have this divided empire. It is Hellenistic. It is a Greek empire. But think of what you got to remember in those days, really from especially from Babylon and especially Persia on. They and the Romans too. Their concern was not that you all become Romans. You all become Greeks. You all become Persian. You've all heard about the Pax Romana, right? Which, if you're Latin, it means what? Peace of Rome. What the Romans cared about was peace in their empire. They and Alexander and really the king of Persia could care less who you worshipped. That was this. You got to remember, this is a world where everybody worships God. It's just your God and your God and your God. He could care less. They have no interest in you becoming worshipers of his God. In the Roman case, in the Egyptian case, and many of them, as long as you included the emperor, and there is some evidence that Alexander kind of got this point too, where he began to see himself kind of deified. As long as you worship the emperor and were peaceful, And in fact, in Rome, there was only one religion who was who were exempted from emperor worship officially, which was the Jews. They were the only ones who were actually officially exempted from that law. So you look at this world map here as we come to the end here. Think of this. Think of what we're combining in this empire. We are combining the mythology of Egypt, the mysticism of India, the Persian religions, the history of Greece with the philosophers. And I remember when we were in Israel on our last trip, we went to Athens. Dr. DeWitt from Grace Bible College, who was a very fine Bible professor, said, "Well, here we are where the West found its mind." You know, but I mean, there's the history of Greece. You know, we learn in elementary school about the Greek gods, you know, all this crazy mythology and the gel, and that's all there. But if you read Plato, Plotinus, Aristotle, Plotinus is later, but it is much deeper than that. Their philosophy was very deep. In fact, there are Christian teachers who have taught that they felt Plato was as close to understanding the God of the Bible as anybody. Incidentally, when we were in Athens, I bought a little statue of Plato, and the lady says, "Oh, you mean Plato?" I said, "Yeah, I mean Plato." Okay. So you've got that. You've got the intellectual birth in the West, and of course, we trace our democracy, democratic roots back to this as well of law. You've got the mythology. You got the mysticism. You've got all this coming together in this hodgepodge of an empire. And this is why we end up with this expansion. If you read Jewish history, it's a little foggy. Why did we end up with so many hundreds of thousands of Jews in Alexandria? Why were these Jewish communities all over the world? Did it go back to the first dispersion by the Assyrian? Where did this come from? Well, you got to remember when an invading army and nation really is traveling, much follows in their train. Captives, mercenaries. In fact, this was a big deal. There were a lot of Greek mercenaries fighting against Alexander. He did not treat them too well. You've got Jews who probably volunteered for army service. You've got, you know, they're going to follow. And in his train, probably a lot of Jews came down to Egypt. A lot of Jews spread out throughout the world. And the word that really characterizes this world is syncretism. That's what it is, syncretism. You've got this mesh of cultures, religions, politics. It's just a mesh. And you've got developing at the same time this, what we would call today, this Orthodox Jewish law observance, which is holding out against this New Age syncretism of their world. This is the background. So next week, what I want to do next week is really focus on the 200s, which really, really, there's a fascinating history that takes place in Palestine. And we want to talk about that in Alexandria next week, because this really sets the stage more and more for the New Testament. Okay? All right, that's it. We're done.